I suspect that if non-competes fall, then the non-solicit clauses will get beefed up, and we'll have to look very closely at negotiating those more heavily, restricting those. I suppose there's also a potential legal argument that a non-solicit clause can be so punitive that it is functionally a non-compete clause and thus might not be enforceable. But again, that requires a lot. We got to work through that. But yeah, tons of other issues in physician contracts. There's tons of other ways that employers can make leaving them problematic.
You're listening to the Pain Matters Podcast, presented by the American Academy of Pain Medicine, the nation's leading podcast for healthcare providers, focused on providing the best care today, tomorrow, and beyond. Each episode, we'll share the latest innovations and practical applications that directly impact how we care for patients and measure success in multidisciplinary care. Let's get started.
This is a special episode related to the April 23rd ruling by the Federal Trade Commission to ban non-competes. We're going to figure out what this means in medicine and specifically pain medicine.
Michael Johnson is a physician contract lawyer. He owns the law firm Michael Johnson Legal. He has helped over 1,000 physicians navigate contract law and has an education curriculum that helps doctors learn more about contract law. He also has an incredible social media presence with over 20,000 followers, and you can find him at the Instagram handle at Physician Contracts. So, Michael, let's get started. Did the Federal Trade Commission really just ban all non-competes this week?
Kind of. Very lawyer answer there, right? They ban non-competes for all employed folks across the country, but that rule doesn't come into effect immediately. There's a pause, and it's probably going to be challenged. There's already some lawsuits filed. We'll get into that, but it's not enforceable yet.
So there are physicians across the country who are in different types of practices, have their contracts set up in different ways. So what are the exceptions to this rule, or does it apply to all physicians?
Yeah, a couple potential exceptions here. The FTC may or may not have jurisdiction authority over not-for-profit entities. A lot of healthcare employers of physicians, are technically not-for-profit entities, so it's questionable whether this ban applies to physicians employed by a not-for-profit. There was some commentary, though, during the FTC's ruling and kind of explanation of their rule that they might feel like certain not-for-profit entities do fall under their jurisdiction, depending on how they operate, how, like, for-profit-y, if you will, they behave. So one of the questions that will need to get worked out over time is whether this applies to not-for-profits in the healthcare space. I know there's a lot of discussion about this issue by the American Hospitals Association, not wanting to create some odd difference between being employed by a for-profit hospital system or a not-for-profit hospital system. We're going to work that out. And then the second potential carve-out is for what the FTC calls senior executives. The existing non-competes for them might be able to stay in effect, but future non-competes might not. Okay, the definition of what is a senior executive was a little bit loose. There was a earning expectation of over $151,000, I believe. Pretty much all physicians are over that income threshold. And then number two, there was a requirement that the senior executive do some sort of managerial leadership, direction, strategy type role and responsibility. So that's a little bit open up to interpretation, right? So like if you're in a C-suite, then yeah, you're probably doing those managerial things. If you're a physician, you know, primarily directly providing clinical care, you know, you may or may not fall under that. It's not clear yet, but we'll see kind of where that goes.
Wow, that's so interesting. All this gray area, you know, if you're a program director or a division chief, are you truly a senior executive? You know, can this apply to you? Does it not apply to you? I've I'm part of these physician groups on various, you know, social media platforms. And these were some of the questions that were coming up. There were some people who were asking, like, do you think I would be considered a senior executive? You know, does this apply to me? And the other part you brought up too, like not for profit, you know, what does that really mean? Does that mean every university employed physician, you know, this doesn't apply to them? So I think those gray areas are definitely something that we'll want to see further worked out. But what is the Federal Trade Commission anyway? What's their role as a regulatory agency and what's their capacity?
Yeah, so the Federal Trade Commission is a federal agency that is set up by Congress, and the commissioners, the directors of the commission, are appointed by the president. Okay. They are charged with protecting American consumers from unfair competition, from anti-monopoly type stuff, from being taken advantage of. They're really not there to protect big business. They're there to protect individuals. So, for example, you know, money laundering scams, cybercrime, that sort of thing. They often push back against that. Some of the prior stuff that they've worked on in healthcare has been trying to limit the monopolistic activities of private equity actors in healthcare. One of the most recent ones was a lawsuit against U.S. Anesthesia Partners challenging their business model. So they're really there to protect consumers, protect individuals, and that's really their primary goal.
So I doubt that the FTC just woke up one day and decided that they're going to do this for, you know, no reason. Was there a certain incident that prompted this? Were there trends in industry that prompted this? Was this specifically about medicine? How did this come to be?
Yeah, so it wasn't specifically about medicine. It was a priority of the Biden administration, and you know, he ran on it back in 2019, 2020 in some ways. But a couple of the main examples that the FTC were very concerned about was actually Jimmy John's. Of all like random employers to really be the center of non-competes, Jimmy John's sandwich makers in some instances were subject to non-compete clauses, something like, you know, if you're making sandwiches for us for 2 years and 5 miles around your work location, you can't work in a similar capacity for anybody else. You know, these are folks that are making probably $10 an hour, and now they're limited in where they can get their next job. That just seems so wildly inappropriate, right? The FTC kind of took note of some of the more extreme examples of non-competes. Another example that they were concerned about was an overnight security guard, I think making minimum wage or pretty close to it, was subject to a non-compete, saying for whatever reason they couldn't work in a similar capacity somewhere else. Like, I don't know, it just doesn't make any sense that an overnight security guard poses a substantial business risk for a business, and the leaving should be protected. It's also important to maybe back up for a moment and understand what is a non-compete. A non-compete is a contract clause that restricts what an employee can do, where they can work typically, both during and after employment. These are clauses that survive the end of employment. You know, you go and you leave your job, you submit your notice of termination. You might think, well, whatever was in my contract before, it's over now because I'm leaving a job. That's not how non-competes work. They follow you, and they can, those terms can be enforceable even for years after you leave a job. So they're very concerned about this for, frankly, more blue-collar type roles or responsibilities. They really weren't thinking about individual physicians and, you know, healthcare environment and private equity involvement in healthcare and that sort of thing when they were kind of formulating this rule.
Let's talk about the first lawsuit sort of fighting against this ruling or trying to overturn this ruling.
Yeah, so the first two that I have read, again, it's April 25th, it's Thursday. So it's only been 2 days, but One was by a tax planning service that said, you know, we operate across the country and we help the folks that we employ understand our internal processes, and it's unfair for us to have to remove our non-competes. It's going to destroy our business model and our business is going to fall apart, that sort of thing. Okay. The second one is probably the bigger one, which is from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Okay. They're an interest group that, you know, obviously has many business owner members, and they filed a lawsuit in the Eastern District of Texas saying that the FTC's ruling is unconstitutional. It goes past their like charter, the rules that Congress set up for them when the FTC was formed, and some other arguments. But what they're asking the court to do in that case is to issue a preliminary injunction from enforcing the non-compete ban. They're, again, it's only been a couple days, but they're likely going to ask the court to say, hey, pause enforcement, don't let it go into effect in 120 days as we're deciding, we're arguing the constitutionality of what the FTC did here. Ultimately, I suspect they'll be successful at least in winning the preliminary injunction, like for the moment, pausing enforcement. An interesting piece here, a lot of these types of lawsuits challenging enforceability of federal agencies are filed in this area, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, this zone, because it houses some of the more conservative jurists, some of the more conservative opinions that are less likely to support expanding power of federal agencies like the FTC. The U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is housed in New Orleans, but they are often viewed as the most conservative appellate court in the U.S. So a lot of these, it is very strategic to place this lawsuit in Texas and try to bring it through the U.S. Fifth Circuit, because they're probably more likely to win a preliminary injunction and pause the enforceability of this rule for the moment.
So this is a good segue into understanding where the jurisdiction lies when it comes to non-compete laws. Should this be in the hands of Congress, or should it lie in the hands of federal agencies like the FTC?
Yeah, and along these lines, like, what makes it more believable or trustworthy, or and what I really mean is, how do we know that the next president isn't going to come in and this is going to go away?
Wow, very good question. So for now, non-competes are a matter of state law. Each individual state can decide the scope and breadth of their non-competes. For example, in California, we haven't had non-competes in like 150 years. A couple other states as well, Oklahoma, North Dakota, and a couple others I'm missing. But for the vast majority of other states, they have had non-competes. Some have like very limited enforceability. For example, in New Mexico, you can't have a non-compete, okay, but you can have a non-solicit clause that lasts for 1 year. So sometimes they carve out like possible exceptions, okay, but it's a matter of each individual state deciding the law of that state. So one of the challenges here is like a states' rights versus federalism, like fundamental constitutional issue. What important issues should be decided at the federal level versus left to each individual state? And obviously, we could talk about this for like hours in the context of like Roe v. Wade versus Dobbs versus a lot of things, but it's also coming to play in non-compete law. Many would say that we all benefit as a nation, and economically, it's best for everybody if we have one clean and clear rule that applies across the country in every instance. I probably fall like on a policy law. I probably fall in that camp, saying we should have one clean, clear rule on a national level. And I think regardless of where you kind of land here, I think it would be better if Congress passed a law instead of having a federal agency pass a rule. We'll talk about that for a minute. So federal agencies are, again, set up by Congress, and the FTC, for example, it has five commissioners. Those commissioners change hands quite regularly, depending on whoever is president. So right now, it's 3-2 in favor of Democrats. But the next election, the next presidential election, or another one in the future, it could switch over. And if another president decides to replace the current commissioners with folks that want to remove the ban on non-competes, then theoretically that could happen. And this rule could be overturned with the next president. I guess there's a whole other rabbit hole we could go down about how that would work. But theoretically, it's not as solid, as secure as it would be if Congress passed an overarching law that clarified non-compete rules across the country. The problem that we have now is an exceedingly inefficient, dysfunctional federal Congress. Like, we can't really get a lot of important rules passed right now. So I don't think that's a very political statement, just kind of reality right this moment. So, you know, the idea of saying, okay, let's just pass a non-compete law, well, we can't really get that done. So a lot of important rules are being passed through federal agencies instead of through Congress. We're seeing this right now with student loan laws and forgiveness and the rules around trying to forgive student loans. Nothing can really move through Congress right now. So the executive branch, the president, is trying to use federal agencies to do what can't be done through Congress. So again, another long discussion about that is certainly possible. But the FTC is a bit limited in their capacity on what they can do. Their budget is set by Congress. So theoretically, if Congress doesn't like what the FTC is doing, they could vote to, you know, severely curtail, limit their budget, basically handcuffing them from a resources standpoint on being able to enforce things. It's not really a good path for anybody, because you have laws out there that may or may not be enforced that creates frustrating gray areas that lead to more confusion and less clarity. But yeah, those are some of the limits on what the FTC can do.
That is so interesting. I mean, I think this was the hardest part in my MPH. I remember I was doing this policy memo work at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. And a big thing was, when you're coming up with policy solutions, like, who can do what? And what does that really mean if this agency does it versus Congress does it? And, you know, as physicians, we just don't have great education about that. And really, just as healthcare practitioners in general, I would say we don't really have that built into our curriculum. And so this is really critical for us to be able to understand this. And so moving on, I mean, who does this favor? There are so many stakeholders here. Of course, there are physicians, there are private equity groups, there are hospitals, there are patients. You know, who benefits and who stands to lose?
So I think the main beneficiary is employed physicians. If this goes to pass and they survive legal challenges, what have you, then individual physicians that are employed by large employers will almost certainly have more freedom of movement. That can be really nice. Private equity groups might be the most harmed here, frankly, because a big part of their business model is buying up practices, restricting the movement of the physicians that were essentially acquired under those contracts, if you will, and rolling bigger groups together and then extracting better rates from insurance companies. So that whole model of the continuity of service from physicians through restrictive non-competes is kind of put at risk. I would also say independent, small physician-owned private practices benefit from this, because they're the ones that are most likely to benefit from an early to mid-career physician leaving Mega Health and wanting to either join a private practice or start their own practice or build out. I hear from a lot of private practice owners that say, hey, we have enough patients, we have some capacity, but it's really hard for us to hire because all of the early to mid-career folks that have experience are trapped by non-competes. We can't bring them over. And when we compete against hospitals and against private equity groups, they can pay more in the very first like day, year, month of the contract. They just have a little bit more money to pay, you know, pay first contract physicians a little bit more. So we're at a bit of a competitive disadvantage. You know, if we remove some of the non-compete barriers, then individual physicians could, you know, still go if they wanted to go to a bigger institution, a large group. And then when they get frustrated with the lack of autonomy and control and limits on the, you know, future of their career, they could then more easily transition out of that system and go to an independent physician-owned private practice, or maybe start a direct primary care or direct care model type practice. I think it will encourage more entrepreneurism, more innovation in like a small private practice setting. We'll see. Okay. But I think that those would be the main beneficiaries. It's also just a little bit open-ended right now. We don't know exactly what's going to happen yet. I would say also small businesses can typically still have non-competes between their co-owners. So for example, let's say you're a pain practice and there's four owners. Everyone owns 25% of the practice, let's say. I don't believe this rule will remove the non-competes between co-owners of a closely held business. So you can still have non-compete agreements that kind of protect the business from certain owners splitting off and starting a competing practice. Okay, that can actually help economic growth because it can help small businesses grow and maintain, you know, a little bit more stability through that process. So I think those are the main like winners and losers here. I think individual physicians will have a little bit more leverage to negotiate against large systems if they can more easily go to a competitor in the same geographic region. So I think it will help folks that want to negotiate a pay raise or want to negotiate some aspect of the work obligations, having more exit options will help provide more leverage.
Is there any way in which physicians could lose?
I would say if you own a small private practice and maybe you're considering a sale to private equity, it could be more difficult for that private equity platform to pay a high price for what your business is worth. If we don't have non-competes, then they could buy your practice and then you could potentially leave and start competing in the same geographic area relatively quickly. Thus, they really haven't bought anything. And these folks are really smart. They're not going to buy things that are not worth it, right? So, you know, if you were very close to paying, you know, being paid a lot of money by a private equity firm, then that might be in doubt. I could see the same principle applying for a practice that was looking at a hospital buyout being acquired by a hospital. You know, if the hospital is buying that private practice, they really want those physicians to stay with the practice after the purchase, right? Non-competes help them, I guess, protect their investment in that purchase. So, you know, the sale price of private practices might be curtailed a bit. That might actually be helpful for innovation in medicine, for the viability of independent physician-owned private practices, that sort of thing. But time will tell.
Does this apply to independent contractors who work through locum agencies, or is it how is it any different than an employer?
It's a really good question. So let's back up for a moment. When I talk about employees, I'm thinking about folks who are paid on what's called a W-2. The employer pays payroll taxes. The employee is taxed as an employee. Okay. It's a little bit different than when the physician is a contractor, an independent contractor, and then is paid under what's called a 1099 form. If you're paid under a 1099, then you are essentially your own small business. You're a micro sole practitioner business owner that then contracts for your services with another business. You're not afforded the various legal protections that are available to employees. I say that broad statement carefully because there's ways to argue that independent contractors really should be employees, and this system of, you know, being able to switch back and forth, you know, may or may not be super enforceable, may not be legal in many states. Okay. If this is you, look very closely at your state or potentially get, you know, a local consult on this. But for example, let's say an independent contractor wants to take FMLA, Family Medical Leave Act, and wants their job to be protected. Theoretically, that FMLA might not be there for an independent contractor because FMLA might only apply to employees. Okay, there's obviously legal claims surrounding that, but that's just a very general statement. So with the FTC, I don't know that they have really addressed this yet, but a lot of physicians do contract as independent contractors. So they're technically not employees. And this was initially, I believe, meant to apply only to employees. So if you have an independent contractor arrangement that has a non-compete in it, then you might still have your non-compete. You know, it might still be enforceable, even if this rule goes through. That's another issue that still needs to get worked out. It's just not crystal clear as it stands on April 25th of 2024. It could be different down the road. We'll see where that goes, though. I would also say, too, for independent contractors, make sure you understand the tax implications of that and what your individual state says about being an independent contractor versus a W-2 employee. There's a lot of movement in this area of the law right now.
How does this change? I mean, this is the million-dollar question, right? So paying physicians, looking at contracts, how does it change how we evaluate contracts? I mean, from what I'm hearing right now, it really shouldn't change anything because we don't know how this will be enforced, if it will be enforced, et cetera. But I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to have much impact in the short term. Right now, it's not enforceable. Okay. Even if it becomes enforceable, I would say it doesn't really change fundamentally how physicians should approach evaluating and negotiating contracts. Just to give you a kind of background here, when we represent physicians in the firm, I'd say maybe 20% of the time, negotiating the non-compete is our number one priority. A lot of times the non-compete is either, you know, not as impactful as many might think, or there's just other things that are more important in the contract. So, like from our practice, I don't think it will fundamentally change much. Okay. Also, we already have examples of this. California hasn't had non-competes in over 100 years, and we still evaluate and negotiate contracts there. There's tons of issues to clarify, to negotiate. It really just doesn't change that much. Okay. And also, just kind of back up, some of the folks who are claiming relative like doomsday impacts of removing non-competes should really just look at California. California alone would be like the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. And, you know, it has a lot of physicians and has a lot of big healthcare systems, and they haven't had non-competes and they work just fine. So I don't think it's going to fundamentally change, you know, just upend the entire healthcare economy here. I think everyone will adjust. I'd also say, too, non-competes are sometimes not as restrictive as the non-solicit clause. This applies maybe even more to folks in pain medicine than it does in other specialties, okay? So often when we're reading contracts, there'll be a restrictive covenants clause that will have restrictions on disclosure, like what you can say about the practice publicly, confidentiality, what you can say to anybody or what you can use out of the business. You'll have the non-compete, which restricts geographically where you can work upon exit. And then you'll also have what's called a non-solicit clause. The non-solicit clause speaks to what you can do with the valuable relationships that you develop during the employment. So you think about the most valuable relationships. You have those with your patients, your coworkers, referral sources, potentially like an ASC or hospital, other facility that you perform procedures at, maybe insurance companies, probably more than that. Okay. The non-solicit clause restricts what you can do with those relationships upon exit. So for example, let's say you're a pain physician, you're leaving a practice, you want to start your own practice. If your non-compete says, okay, you can't work for 2 years and for 10 miles around this one location, cool, we can go 10.1 miles away and it's pretty clear that that location is not a problem, right? But if they have a non-solicit of referral sources, that could be really rough. Imagine all of the different sources of patients, where your patients came from. Maybe there was primary care docs. Maybe there was like a litigation component where there's referrals from lawyers. Maybe wherever you got your patients, it really just depends, right? Sometimes the non-solicit clause says you can't accept patients that come from the same referral sources that sent you patients during your employment with us. That's even rougher than a non-compete, and it's even more gray, more confusing. You often will have some sort of restriction on what you can do with your former patients. Some of the more aggressive ones will say you can't see any patients that were a patient of any doctor at the employer, you know, while you're working for us. So let's say you're in a group of five pain physicians and, you know, you leave, you start your own practice, and a patient comes to you and said, yeah, you know, your former colleague, Dr. So-and-so, treated me a year ago. Can I work with you? Sometimes a non-solicit clause calls that relationship into question. Can you even accept that patient? Okay, these get exceedingly aggressive. I suspect that if non-competes fall, then the non-solicit clauses will get beefed up, and we'll have to look very closely at negotiating those more heavily, restricting those. I suppose there's also a potential legal argument that a non-solicit clause can be so punitive that it is functionally a non-compete clause and thus might not be enforceable. But again, that requires a lot. We got to work through that. But yeah, tons of other issues in physician contracts. There's tons of other ways that employers can make leaving them problematic. I guess one of the last things I want to leave everybody with, you know, the whole like fundamental purpose of physician contracts for employers, particularly large employers, is to reduce turnover. It's really not about restricting unfair competition locally. You have these massive systems that's so vertically integrated. You know, practically speaking, a physician leaving and starting a local practice isn't going to touch them, okay? But the turnover, the cost of a physician changing jobs can be very, very dramatic. The AMA came out with an article not that long ago that said on average, every time a physician turns over, it costs that system anywhere between $500,000 and $1 million. When you think about lost productivity for staff, you know, just not having a physician in that role for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, whatever. You have the recruitment costs of a new physician joining the practice. You got to pay them a signing bonus. You got to pay recruiters. You got to, you know, do a lot of stuff. When you start adding up all of those costs, also like when a physician joins a new practice, there's usually an initial negative delta where they're ramping up their practice. They're building their practice. So when you add all of those economic impacts up together, getting to a half a million or a million per every physician turnover is really easy to do. So a lot of employers, you know, look at their contracts in a way to say, okay, how can we reduce our biggest financial risk? And they often point to non-competes as a way to reduce turnover, but there's a ton of other clauses. One is the non-solicit clause. There's term and termination clauses that can be very punitive. A lot of physician contracts build in compensation clawback and waiver issues where you end up having to give back or give up a bunch of money to leave employment, okay? Some contracts will require physicians to pay their malpractice insurance and tail coverage upon exit, which could be a 5 or even 6-figure expense to leave. There's tons of other contract like leverage points that they can use. And I suspect some employers will say, well, we can't use non-competes anymore, so let's beef up these other tools we have in physician contracts. So fundamentally, I don't think it's going to change everything, but it is a move in the right direction. If it stands, if it passes, it's a move in the right direction for individual physicians and autonomy and control over their careers and their life plans.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you've started to address this, but what are the broader implications of this on the overall economy? I say we kind of end with that.
Yeah. So my hope is that removing non-competes spurs independent physician-owned private practice growth. It gives folks that were potentially pausing on starting their own practice locally because of the existence of a non-compete to go ahead and make that leap and to do that. I think that on a macro level, the migration from independent practice or solo practice into direct hospital employment or employment by a private equity platform, I don't know that that's making physicians happier. And I think there's research out there that suggests it's not great for patients. And, you know, it's really not maybe best for the economy as a whole. So for individual, for physicians, for healthcare, my hope is that it spurs more independent practice, more growth, and thus would be better for physicians, for patients, for competition, that sort of thing. When I'm negotiating contracts, a big important leverage piece is, what is the next best option? If there really isn't a next best option because private practice is not flourishing in that geographic area, and there's a buyout of all competing practices, there's essentially a monopoly on healthcare in a geographic area, then our negotiation leverage goes down. So physician compensation goes down, physician autonomy goes down, a number of other negative impacts. So my hope is that this spurs economic growth. And that's supported by what the FTC also looked at when they were making this rule. You know, the FTC is primarily economists. They're not lawmakers. They're not, you know, elected officials. They're from the economic community. You know, they're looking at research and trying to decide, they're often lawyers as well, but they're looking at research and trying to decide what would spur economic growth. So that's one of the main reasons that they came to this conclusion that non-competes do not, you know, advance our economy, spur economic growth. And I agree, I'm hopeful that it moves in the right direction for physicians.
You know, Michael, when this news first broke, me and Shravani were talking about, you know, the podcast, setting it up. This was sort of a last minute, very quickly put together thing. And we knew that there was so much that we didn't know about this. But just having this conversation with you, it uncovered so many more things that we actually didn't realize or didn't understand. So this is such an invaluable episode for us, our listeners, physicians across the country, whether they're in pain medicine or not, quite frankly. And we just want to thank you so much for taking the time so quickly to come on and educate us. And I hope everyone, again, gives Michael a follow at Physician Contracts on Instagram. He's great on there. And thank you to Dr. DeBacala for being a host. And thank you to the American Academy of Pain Medicine for hosting the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I just want to add on to that. I want everyone to know. So again, this rule happened on April 23rd and it's April 25th. So, you know, I contacted Michael last night before I went to dinner and came back from dinner kind of late. And, emailed him, got Mustafa on board, and you know, we are so excited that he can be with us because he's a very busy lawyer and actually just had a very small window of time for us. So we're so grateful. And again, thank you to AAPM for hosting this podcast. We'll see you next time. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Pain Matters podcast. If you have any questions about the content that we covered today, or if you'd just like to continue the conversation, please tweet us at AmerAcadPainMed. That's AmerAcadPainMed with the hashtag PainPod. If you like what you heard, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and review on your podcast player to help us reach and educate even more of our peers in pain medicine. Until next time, I'm Dr. Shravani Dabrakala, and this is the Pain Matters Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Pain Matters Podcast. If there's anything we mentioned in today's show you missed, don't worry. We take the notes for you at painmed.org/podcast. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider pressing the subscribe button on your podcast player so you never miss a future episode. And don't forget to leave us a rating and review to help us reach and educate even more of our peers in pain medicine.